Hello and welcome to the Vegelease Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Vegelease and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. Kazakhstan held parliamentary elections on March 19th, the latest step in what Kazakh President Kasym Jomart Tokayev says is part of the process of creating a new Kazakhstan. But the old problem of labor strikes and labor disputes remain. And when unemployed oil workers from the western city of Zhanaozen made their way to the capital, Astana, on April 9th, Kazakh authorities dealt with the issue in the same old way. What do the recent demonstrations in Astana tell us about new Kazakhstan? To discuss all this, I am joined by Asel Tutumlu, lecturer at the Department of International Relations and Political Science at Near East University in Nicosia, and Luca Ancescu, professor of Central Asia Studies at Glasgow University. Thank you both for being on the program. And Asel, let's start with you. What can you tell us about what happened with the Zhanaozen oil workers who came to Astana? What did they want, and how did officials respond?
Well, it's not the first time that they are coming. Last year, they were also organizing a similar type of action, where they came to the Ministry of Energy and camped there, and the Ministry of Energy managed to solve their problem. Particularly, they arrived on April 10th, not they, but specifically the workers of Berali Mangustal, which is a relatively smaller drilling company, drilling and oil service company, that won the bid from Ozen Munay Gas to conduct operations for a year. They won the bid in August, and it's a relatively kind of grassroots company where the oil workers managed to come together. They bought the new equipment and organized the company, got the license, and they were very happy that in August they were able to get the contract, which was relatively small. It included about four different places and equal to about 1 million, if I'm over a million, over $1 million, I guess, operations. And then what happened is that during the new economic year in April, they were informed in March that they've lost the bid. And this particular bid went to their rivals, which is the Kesby company and another company that was just recently registered and no one really knew about it. And Kesby is a much bigger company, although not as big, for example, as Ozen Munay Gas's own service company. But they won it, and as a result of that, about 180 workers were unemployed. So they decided to go to the Ministry of Energy and do the same thing again, where they would actually camp in front of the energy Ministry of Energy and try to attract attention so that their problems are going to be solved. Unfortunately, during the first day, nobody from the ministry came out to them. The Minister of Energy basically said that, well, they are doing a hype. So it's all, they're trying to attract the hype. Because they are conditions and claims are not necessarily consistent. So the minister basically thought that it's not, there is no reason to actually step in there. So indeed, the claims were not necessarily focused. Initially, they wanted to be the bid, initial bid to be revised to see if there were indeed violations or not. And then the second thing, later on, when many more workers joined them the next day, they wanted to get employment in Ozen Munay Gas, which is, as I said, a relatively large company, and it has a waiting list of nearly, according to different sources, including Orda KZ, 9,000 people are on that list to be employed. And then Kazmunay Gas representative came out to them saying that, well, we can offer you this employment in Kesby, the company, that current company that won the bid, and we can potentially have some other people working in another company. But nonetheless, it didn't really satisfy the workers. And in the evening of April 11th, the security forces, they rounded up people, cleaned up the site, and took them to the police stations. So they were kept at the police stations. And when people in Zhanaozen heard that, about from 1,000 to 2,000 people came out in Central Square. They were all organized and peaceful. The reports were happening that a lot of people were also gathering in Uralsk and Aktau to support Zhanaozen workers. By midnight, the Akim, the of Amangas Tau region, came out to them and said, you know, we're working on solving the problem. So please, if you can, you can actually leave, and so on. And in the morning of the 12th, different videos started to appear where the Asian Asian workers are basically saying, okay, we left 10 activists there and we're coming home. The government organized a train ride for them and people were basically dismissed. It was a tense moment. Because as usual, government turned off internet in Zhanaozian and in parts of Astana. So people were again preparing for Vladi Kantar events, so deja vu of that. But apparently today, so far, the situation has been handled. Negotiations continue, but at least people are no longer on the squares. So that's what has been happening, and reliving this moment of no information and internet blackout was indeed very terrifying for many people. Since Zhanaozian workers were arrested in the evening, and nobody really heard what is happening, and information came from the information from police forces came relatively late.
Okay, thanks, Estelle. And I just want to, before I let you go, I wanted to do a little follow-up. We're talking about the Zhanaozian oil workers, but even since parliamentary elections, they're not the only oil workers that have been out on demonstrating. Is this correct?
Yes, absolutely. The demonstrations have been happening relatively regularly in Zhanaozian, and it's the only way for them to acquire some kind of, to make their voices heard. Apparently, the protests allow these people to get to the two Akims, get to the officials who are responsible for making decisions over employment and over social and welfare payments in general. So that's the only way for them to do that, unfortunately, because the labor unions have been put under control and legally there's not much room for them to fight for their rights except for the mass strikes.
Okay, thank you. Luca, would you see the videos that came out of Astana just a couple of days ago of the workers outside the building and the police moving in on them and circling them and actual fighting breakout? What do you think about that? I mean, what does that say about President Tokayev and his second republic or new Kazakhstan?
Well, he says that pretty much there is no such thing as a second republic as a new Kazakhstan. Even when Astelbo was speaking before, this all sounded to me as if we've been there before. And in fact, we've been there before in terms of the protests. We've been there in terms of the grievances behind the protests, but we've also been there in terms of the crisis management of the Kazakhstani government. So it is an entire deja vu, which tells me two things. The first one, and obviously they unfortunately both negative for Kazakhstan and the Kazakhstani people in general. The first is that Kazakhstan is a petrol state because, especially within the oil sector, energy sector in particular, labor relations, production relations are now entering a phase of irreversible crisis. So unless some significant change is brought up in the way in which the largesse, the Kazakhstan largesse is managed by the elite, but also it's the way in which it's the industry itself, it's implemented, operationalized within and beyond labor relations, I think that there is no way back. I mean, this is such a significant part of the economy, which requires such a significant amount of change, that this is a chronic issue now. And so the current model of Kazakhstan energy resource management, the one that was established in the Nazarbayev era, in that sense, to me, it has failed. And it's not just now, in the last decade, but we've seen that now the repetition of grievances, the return to people on the square, the fact that, you know, since the Kazakhstani government, both before and after 2019, has completely dismantled the trade union system, has led these people to have to become agent of their own labor. So they express, the workers are expressing the grievances themselves. I mean, the wholesale import of neoliberal labor relation in the sector is something which has been happening for 30 years now. So I think that that model of energy state, petrol state has failed. The second point that you know, listening to Astiel, reading what's happening in Kazakhstan, it makes me think that there is no such thing as a new Kazakhstan. Because what we've seen the last 12 months, you know, ever since this moniker was forged, is a very inward-looking regime. A regime that spent the last year only managing the elite, making sure that the people that were close to the former president were being marginalized, appointing these missing people. They had some kind of relationship with Nazarbayev and his power system. And that was executed fairly surgically with three votes. I mean, the constitutional referendum, the presidential election, and less than a month ago, the parliamentary election. So now we have an elite that is entirely and exclusively accountable to Tokayev. That's the only novelty, though. The policies have not changed. The structure of the political landscape will not be modified. The way in which the state interacts with its citizens, you know, this is the idea of the listening state is gone. And in that sense, it seemed to me that we've seen the same Kazakhstan just with a new boss, which in fact isn't even that new because it's been there since the 1990s. So this idea that you can sort of transform the country without really doing it, any kind of significant change, heavy lifting as well, is becoming very, very much visible now. And the fact that these grievances return and the state responds always in the same time, it makes me think that there is no novelty. And it doesn't really matter if you say you knew. Everyone can see that it's not really new.
So do you have any follow-up to that? Any thoughts on what Luca was just saying?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I really like the two things that Luca said that I wanted to expand. The idea is that the model of resource management, but we can also talk about the model of labor management. I think this is very important as well, because it enables the government to be in denial of the whole extraction and the situation in which the population is actually put into. I mean, the bloody events of the January events of 2022 have shown that the majority of population, actually, if you take a look at the mean salary, only gets 50,000 tenge, which is an extremely, extremely small amount. And it's impossible to survive with this money, not only in the capital and big cities, but even in small towns. It's very difficult to survive, considering all the expenses, including the basic utilities. And in addition to that, for the oil workers, what has been done is that since the most of the, let's say, big, the commanding heights of economy, let's say, is in the hands of the state or international investors, the workers experience a lot of precarity because a lot of contracts, it seems like there are secure contracts if you are able to work for state institutions or those companies, national companies that are affiliated with state institutions like Kazmunaygaz. Ozenmonogaz is the subsidiary of Kazmunaygaz. And as a result of that, Ozenmonogaz, for example, has its own servicing company. And in order to support and create employment, they are basically giving some very minor services and jobs to other companies that are much smaller. And so the other workers who did not manage to get this very nice labor spots, they end up working on in very poor conditions, relatively smaller salaries. So, for example, if you're working for Ozenmonogaz, your salary would be like 1 million and you have all kinds of benefits. You can send the kids to various camps and stuff like this. And the workers in these particular smaller companies, they not only get the smaller salaries, but also their contracts are very predatory, where they cannot really leave, they cannot take vacation, they receive much smaller salaries, and they have to find jobs. When one company loses contract, they have to basically go to another company and look for, take whatever job that comes their way. And so that's part of the reason why the workers that came over were so much against the proposal of Kazmunay Gas to basically transition to another company, because that's not going to solve their problem. A year from now, when there is another bid, they will then be in the same situation. And it also explains why workers from the company that won the bid, KESBI, were also supporting the Berali Mangostao company, the workers that were actually protesting, because they all understand that they're in the same condition. So there has to be a kind of a systemic decision over the model of labor management, where people get very transparent, at least transparent and equal opportunities for labor that is done with the same quality or for different companies, but of the same quality. We unfortunately don't really have that. And it's really kind of a wild market out there really kind of divides the labor with co-opts the labor, certain labor who manage to get positions in national companies versus those who are outside. And that really, really establishes awful conditions. Another thing that I wanted to talk about is the new Kazakhstan that Luca mentioned, that it's actually a fake notion. And I think it has been, many people recognize that new Kazakhstan doesn't exist after the way government handled January protesters, where torture, violence, death has been a regular and a natural thing. So that's crisis management technique that uses law enforcement, kind of fear tactic. Pressure is nothing new, especially for districts in Western Kazakhstan that has experienced and practiced strikes for quite a long time, and not only strikes, but forms of public organization to basically put the claims out in the table. It was so surprising to see how, for example, the government workers actually reacted to the strikes, pointing them out as presenting them as kind of lazy people, as people who do receive a lot of money, and why are they actually protesting? Because their salary is relatively high. And unfortunately, this is not very, this tactic of divide and rule is not going to actually, again, solve or do anything well for the region. So instead of actually conducting a kind of systematic changes and reforms in labor management and labor regulations, they prefer to basically demonize the workers and present them as people who have very big ambition and they are too lazy to do something about it, especially since Kazmunay Gas offered them equal conditions as before. So I think it's very important to understand that what the government is trying to do. And it all is part of this crisis management technique that Luca just pointed out.
Thank you. Luca, you know, you had mentioned that they dismantled the unions. And if we go back to Jeanne Ozen, the tragedy in December 2011, you know, it's been more than 11 years, and it'll be 12 at the end of this year. The government did dismantle the unions, but they just don't seem to be able to resolve this issue. I mean, it goes on and on and on. What are some of the reasons you think that this issue just keeps hanging out there? I mean, it seems like there's never a resolution that satisfies anybody?
No, I think that this is something which we've seen across Central Asia, really, where the management of resources currently is understood only as a process that should work for the elite rather than for the people widely understood. And, you know, I can give an example, you know, the fact that you have workers in Jeanne Ozen going, you know, and protesting on the street a regular intervals, really, that this year, last year, a few more times in the late Nazarbayev era, it tells you that the grievances that they have, they are never addressed. The structure of production has been changed. It's a region that is suffering dramatically. The decline of the industry is a region where there are entire families that for generations had been exclusively involved in the energy industry, and now they seeing this industry being dismantled and sort of by the transformation of the economy, but also by the fact that is now Kazakhstani oil sector is it's a neoliberal instrument in the hands of the government. But also, you know, the region has got serious environmental issues. It's got serious unemployment issues, and it is very poorly managed at local level. So, it's also very far away, and this is not from the center. It's not a region where I can specialize in all this economic sector because of the geography and the orography of the place. So, has been left out. Has been left out of the development of Kazakhstan. And but see, there is a repeated failure by Nazarbayev, Tokayev, even in the years of the tandem, if you want to call it 2019, 2022. They never intervened. They never intervened to have a serious plan or transformation of the economy of the Western Kazakhstan Oblast. Obviously, and by any chance, even the other regions, you know, like local politics in Kazakhstan, it's not of any use for the government. So this idea that the workers should not really interfere with the process that makes the government richer, and the people at large should not really benefit for the very substantive reserves that the government gets by exporting this oil, the uranium, or the kind of minerals Kazakhstan is so rich of, is something which will continue to pop up in any kind of grievances. I mean, obviously, the oil workers in Western Kazakhstan have now an established way of protesting and making their grievances heard. They go onto the street, you know, this time they even traveled to Astana. They must have been exasperated. But I am sure that, you know, that there is a significant the proliferation of micro protests and micro, if you want, little sort of fights that emerge in Western Kazakhstan for very localized issue. But you only need to have a look at the local papers. The local papers, they always report some kind of minor demonstration or local fight to change one or the other issue. So there is an issue of marginalization, not just geographically or culturally, but actually socially and economically of Western Kazakhstan. And it's something which is problematic because that's a region that contributes most significantly to the economy. So it's the persistence of these problems and the government's sustained failure in addressing them that has not changed, does not alter the balance of the situation. So there is a disenfranchising. The people feel disenfranchised. And but obviously, again, all it matters here is who runs the sovereign wealth fund, who makes the money out of it, how the big families in Astana and in Kazakhstan budget business community prosper on the back of the energy largesse. So there is this detachment between, if you want, the big oil politics and localized oil politics, which are just not just limited to the oil, come to the labor, but to the wider population in general, that are disconnected. Now, how long this can go on? Well, Central Asia obviously teaches some harsh lesson here. We've got the same dynamic at play in Turkmenistan. It's been like that for 25 years now and has not been changed. Well, Kazakhstan is a different country. There is a different cultural protest. There is a different landscape. Is this sustainable? Well, if these protests stay localized, the government will not intervene. But how much of this can go on? I mean, how often can this protest be repeated without having seen another kind of large scale sort of crisis erupting in Kazakhstan? The problem is always the same. To me, if there is not a serious intervention in the way in which Central Asia, in this case Kazakhstan, energy is understood and is put into serious policy making, well, we will see this happening over and over again. And the fact that you have a supposedly new regime reacting exactly the same way the old regime did. So, you know, shutting down the internet, all that kind of repressive playbook. Well, it seemed to me that not only they have not understood the problem, they also have not understood how to solve the problem.
So let's go to you. I mean, endlessly curious about this whole thing. Now, I can understand that the oil workers have pretty much a legitimate grievance here. It would be fair to say that the new city of Astana was built from the oil money that they got from Western Kazakhstan. And yes, yeah, anyone that drives through Western Kazakhstan will see it's kind of a, still poverty-stricken, underdeveloped area in Kazakhstan. And these strikes keep coming up and up again. And this kind of echoes the question I asked to Luca. But what is the problem with trying to develop some kind of policy to deal with this? I mean, we had, I think it was the deputy prime minister of Kazakhstan, who almost echoed something Nazarbayev said a few years ago. When the oil workers were outside the energy ministry, he just basically said, what's their problem? That's just the way it goes. Why do we have to give them work? And it reminded me of Nazarbayev saying, why do these people want their loans forgiven? Let them buy two cows and get milk or something like that and sell that. And why are they asking the government for money? So that's it. What is the problem with developing a policy for these workers out there and failure to see that they have legitimate grievances?
Well, it's a great question. And I think the answer lies in the structure of political economy in Kazakhstan. The problem why we consistently over the years cannot necessarily resolve the problem of not only oil workers, but as Luca pointed out, a kind of a larger model of resource management that benefits the elites, is because elites, unfortunately, are in charge, or the financial industrial groups are actually in charge of the decision-making process. Not only informal decision-making process, but also very frequently formal decision-making process. So, for example, these companies actually offer the legal drafts. So it's not necessarily written by our deputies. Our deputies frequently read the drafts that were presented by lobbyists of these companies. We also know that some deputies, for example, openly lobby interests of different financial groups, either because they are affiliated with them or because they find it expedient at this particular moment. And so that's why regular people, they don't necessarily have the opportunities to influence the political process outside elections and even during elections. And I think this is what has been especially devastating to many observers, especially at home in Kazakhstan, is that neither the constitutional referendum, presidential or parliamentary elections went in any different way. They were all conducted in the same manner. And we cannot, and that actually very much exposed the fakeness of this new Kazakhstan, because there was nothing new. Even though the independents were eligible to run, unfortunately, there were so many violations that basically none of them ended up in the final lists and in the parliamentary elections in the parliament. So for many people, they feel that there is absolutely no way, no institution, no person to speak on their behalf, no political party. And as a result of that, the only way that they can actually express their opinion is through protests and pickets, either individual, because only individual pickets are now allowed, or basically or through the mass protests and strikes. And in that sense, the labor management model can change only if the strikes are massive. And I think Zhenaozian, people who, the oil workers in Zhenaozian, understand that, that if they suspend production, if they, for example, stop working for a certain amount of time, days and so on, then they attract attention. Then it becomes a problem. And as you can see here, in this case, they didn't go to Kazmunaigaz, who is basically who organized the bid, a company which organized the bid and hired their rivals. They went directly to the Ministry of Energy because they know that the Ministry of Energy will be able to solve their problem by either increasing the volume, as they've done before last year, and giving more orders to Ozenmonagas. And so the workers receive not only compensations, but salaries and relative stability, but only for a year, or they, as they hoped for, the Ministry of Energy can potentially assist them in employment. So that's why there is, it's a very kind of pessimistic and negative outlook why there we don't necessarily see the policy reform, because again, it's very much hijacked by special interests, which unfortunately lie too close to the regime in power.
Luca, you know, it's the Oxa Society, for instance, has this protest tracker, and it's curious that the number of protests, even among oil workers in Kazakhstan, but generally among workers in Kazakhstan, has increased substantially since Tokayev came in. Any thoughts on why that might be true? I mean, are they just sick of this and they're finally ready to break, or they see that him being the president now marks some transition point and now's the time to make a move?
No, I would say that the number of protests had intensified and became more frequent because the situation is becoming unbearable. I think that since the governance has not changed, since the state continues to see the oil industry and the general economy, you know, more widely just as a way to getting rich, I think that the condition now have changed because you no longer have the oil boom, oil high prices or prior decades. So you have a significant, you know, as Serbo mentioned before, deterioration of living standards in Kazakhstan. The Nazarbayev dream is over. You could see it when you visit. Beyond the big cities, there is a general sense of decay. And so to me, this becomes obviously even amplified when you go to the Western region, which is probably one of the most, well, experiencing the harshest crisis. So I think that there is the correlation is between the deterioration of the economic standards of the country and deterioration and the fact that these workers would like their voice to be heard. Anyway, and I said mentioned before the fact that now understand that it's the state that deals with the grievances. So they bypass completely the companies and went straight to the Ministry of Energy. And which tells you that there is in the mind of the people the attribution of responsibility to state structures. So there is not intermediaries who, you know, who have been, say, well, this is because of the company, blah, 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 or because it is because of the state. So in that sense, this is an indication of the maturity of the Kazakhstani people at large, or the oil sector in particular, that they recognize that it's the state that should fix their issues. So I think that this is the reason why, Bruce. I mean, had we had this podcast, 15, 16 years ago, we would have talked of a very different economy. The economy was doing very, very differently. Now, obviously, you have 10 years of policy immobility because the president should have gone and didn't resign. So, this protracted long goodbye that sort of froze any kind of significant decision making. And then you had the start of what has been a particularly troublesome presidency. He came in, people didn't recognize Tokayev as legitimate because he continued to understand the votes just as a fictional form of democracy. And then, of course, you had the big event of January 2022, which, interestingly, and maybe us as a community of scholars should have put more, this more central, started as a set of economic grievances not being heard by the government. So 22, then it became about the elite coup, or if you want, the artists protesting in Almaty, or what you want. But at the beginning, it was an issue about living standard and price of LPG in Western Kazakhstan. So it was something very similar to what we saw, this week, which means that they have done nothing to address these issues. There has not been no sensitivity in terms of addressing these grievances first. All they care about it is to purging the elite, bringing their men in, and actually making sure that the regime is now strong enough to keep doing what they were doing. So if this is a sign of novelty, well, I'm not really sure. But to me, that's why. So there is an attribution of responsibility, but also the fact that the people expected more. I mean, the new Kazakhstan idea is copied from the new Uzbekistan idea. You know that, but the new Uzbekistan actually had something new. Maybe because the politics before were so bad that just unfreezing a few processes were actually felt by the people as a signal that something were changing. But, you know, in Kazakhstan, I don't really see this kind of... I see continuity. I see continuity between before 19th of March 2019 and after. I see no change at all. If you change the actors, but the place stays the same, well, it's the same play, isn't it? So in that sense, it's clear to me that the people are now recognize that there is responsibility by the regime in failing to address what are significant economic issues. And that's why they go to the streets, because it's becoming unbearable. And unfortunately, it's exactly like that.
I just would like to add something, Bruce, if I can.
Yes, please.
It's just that the parallel with the bloody January were also were too significant. And that's because if last year, for example, I remember government set the price cap for the LPG, but the price caps only worked for a year. And they've managed to extend it. But now, since diesel and other types of fuels are important for the agricultural workers especially, it created strong shortages in the market. And with the strong shortages in the market, the prices for fuel went up. So when the Janaozian workers came out, they also came out kind of in the same environment of growing prices. And when the prices for fuel go up, obviously that means, and everyone understands that in Kazakhstan, that all the prices will go up automatically. And it's already unbearable. And I totally agree with Luca's opinion that indeed the situation and the conditions became unbearable in many different ways. Not only, for example, the prices for the real estate, but the prices for regular food, for example. The inflation became so high that, and unfortunately, the salaries in Kazakhstan are not indexed with inflation, not even with official inflation. And so people are on their own receiving the same salaries for years while inflation is just skyrocketing. The prices of food, for example, tripled. Now, for example, if you want to go to the store, I mean, people always complain that for the same amount of money, they're able to buy 1/3 of the basket that was available to them a year and a half ago, for example, or 2 years ago. And so it really is a difficult condition for many people. And even though government is trying to increase, for example, salaries for teachers and the pensions, the increment is so small that people are actually not even believing in the validity of this type of actions, because even with increased prices and indexed salaries, for example, they also know that prices will also automatically go up. So it's a really a relatively vicious circle that the government also needs to revise, because again, the situation with the fuel prices has not been reformed, and it also increased the tensions, I guess. And so when Janaozian workers came out, people also came out in Uralsk, for example, in Ural and in Atarau. And in Atarau, both of these places had very different grievances. For example, Atarau has been covered in smoke for quite a long time. So people were basically sick and tired of the mismanagement in Western Kazakhstan in different areas, but cumulatively all related to the quality of living.
No, great. Thank you. We're getting close to the end of the show, but these points that you were making, both you and Luca, I think are really significant because, you know, we know that the government treats political protests differently than they treat labor demonstrations and labor strikes, right? You can strike for higher wages. That's okay. And sit out there for a long time, but you can't come out as an opposition party or opposition group and criticize the government. Yet, labor protests, as they continue after 2 or 3 weeks, they start out as we want more money, we want better benefits, and then when they don't get that right away and they're still out protesting, they start to grumble about local officials and their shortcomings, and then it's provincial officials, and then it's government officials. So I'm really curious, you know, they permit the the labor demonstrations, but not the political protests. And yet the labor demonstrations, as you mentioned, develop into political protests. So what is the government, you know, how do you view the government's policy on this? It seems like a failure to, you know, on the one hand say, we're not going to let Jean Bolot Mamai and his group register, and we're going to tell him he can't speak anymore in public for 6 years. And at the same time, allow the labor protests, labor demonstrations to go on, knowing that if they go on for several weeks, they're going to become anti-government protests. So your thoughts on that, or any last comments that you wanted to make about this issue? I'll start with you, Luca.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that obviously there is, as you said, Bruce, a clear separation between campaigning or protesting for political rights, or campaigning or protesting for a better life, you know, or better labor conditions. So the problem with translating economic grievances into wider demand for wider reforms is that there is no such thing as an opposition who could translate these grievances into a political agenda, because the government had been extremely successful in pretty much obliterating any oppositional force from the Kazakhstani landscape. I mean, the parliament is, you know, it's multi-party, but only if you believe that it's so. The reality is that those five parties are five fingers of the same, or the same end, which, you know, as Tokayev said. So to me, and it's another trend which you see across Central Asia replicated, you know, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan and so forth. So I don't really think there is anyone who can become the political champion of the rights of those workers. And I mean, and again, the fact that trade unions can be so heavily crushed by the government, and now that the oil workers are becoming self-representative, sort of almost itemized individual actors, you know, as if they were striking as part of a gig economy, though they are collective workers. It shows that the government has been very successful in also crushing that kind of organized labor. You know, this is a more repressive Kazakhstan. You saw it, you know. You mentioned people have been sort of given suspended sentences. There are journalists given 15 days of detention for just saying the truth. This has been intensified very much so after the pandemic, but even more so after the 2022 events. So I would say that there is a tie, the possibility for confrontation, but I think that we will see that we will hear about these protests more and more. But I don't really think that there is a possibility of having or seeing the rise of a political movement that embodies, champions these instances, and formulates a wider agenda that the people of Kazakhstan can coalesce in. That wasn't certainly the case in 2022. Whatever my colleagues think, I don't think that was the case. But I would say that the landscape has not changed. This government has been really successful in their agenda of retaining this monopoly over the conversation in Kazakhstan. It was seen happening in social media, the economic sphere, the political sphere, pretty much everything. So it is the question you and I, Bruce, have been asking about Turkmenistan: how long can this go on? And obviously it can go on for a long time, because and that's my last point before I give it back to Asel. There was so much expectation about what a post-Nazarbayev order could do, and this expectation had been disappointed on a daily basis. We no longer talk about policy, we no longer talk about changes, we no longer talk about how the country can be reformed. All that we've been thinking about is making sure we have a new set of deputies in the Majlis. You change the constitution so Tokayev can stay until the late 2020s. A bit of debate on whether or not Kazakhstan should be more vocally or less vocally pro-Ukraine or anti-Ukraine. That's all we got. But the crucial issues, how to organize the state after the president is gone, how to deal with the economy, how to plan for the post-oil economy, or even how to better manage the largesse Kazakhstan has in the energy, but also in the extractive sector at large. These are all topics that have disappeared completely. at least for where I stand. So the expectation, and these are crucial, because even if you have some kind of a more pluralist Kazakhstan, which you don't, you still need to have this conversation. This is the most important sector of the state or the economy, and you still don't debate them. And the same attention that the Uzbek government has had vis-a-vis instigating some economic change, I've never seen it happening in Kazakhstan. I had the rhetoric about multi-vector foreign policy, about the listening state, at some point even about redistribution of wealth. They're gone. These are all things that they're gone. It took the government of Uzbekistan 6 or 7 years to lose the reform impetus, the energy. Kazakhstan, less than 12 months. So obviously, I mean, I'm always a negative voice. I don't want to be like that. But I think that it is very disappointing, to say the least.
A great comment. Asel?
Yeah, thank you so much. I just think that, and I agree in that sense with Luca, that political protesters, they usually have a face. They usually have a person behind it. And as a result of that, that face has a voice that can attract people, that can potentially lead people, mobilize them. And so obviously they are dangerous, even if it is, for example, a single picketer. That comes out in a central square, for example, with empty sheet of paper, that is still a potential person, a leader that can mobilize the people behind him or her. And so that's dangerous. Same thing goes for bloggers. And I think that's the reason why government is so intolerant to protests that can be personalized. But it enables, for example, massive protests against, for example, gender-based violence, labor strikes. It allows for that because it doesn't really have a face. And because of that, it's easier to control. And also it's easier to kind of frame these protests as specific people, for example, specific oil workers who have been too spoiled with their salaries that they don't necessarily want to work for an alternative that government is offering them, for example, or specific women that have been so disgruntled instead of having children and raising children at home, they have nothing else to do but to go, for example, and protest for their rights. So this type of impersonal, let's say, protests are not necessarily very antagonistic, are very dangerous to the regime. And they can be easily co-opted. They can be certainly framed. And also government is able to silence their voices with alternative information fallout. So during this time, we've noticed, for example, during the Zhinaozian strikes, we've noticed that so many deputies in the new parliament came up with really awful ideas so that to distract attention of people. It's not only the idea that it appeared, the idea that Kazakhstan should pay, foreign women that marry the foreigners should pay the tax to the state for marrying local women. This idea was actually circulating even before that, before the Zhinaozian strikes. But nonetheless, it really kind of took the attention. And I don't really remember the details, but at least five different deputies came up with the really atrocious suggestions. And it was, again, the tactic of the government to basically dissipate and divide attention of people away from the tragedy that was actually happening in front of the Ministry of Energy, where people were rounded up and taken to police stations. So, and I agree with Luca that the depersonalized protests will probably continue, but the political opposition with the voice and the face and the personality will probably be severely punished. And we have seen that even the former Majlis member was actually, who wanted to come over and talk to the workers, was arrested for 15 days just because the government was so much afraid, or the regime, let's say, not the government only, but the regime was very much afraid that he may instigate some kind of support behind him, as well as bloggers such as Mukhtar Taijan and Jean-Bulat Mamai was also, as we know, the court prohibited him from participating in any political activities for 6.5 years. Tejan, Mukhtar Tejan was also sentenced to 15 days as well. So all of that implies that if you are an unknown politician, it would be easier for these people to engage in kind of political action than a person who has a recognized identity. And without the systematic reforms, I think this type of strikes and protests will continue.
Great, thank you. And I know we could talk a lot more about this, and I have a feeling we will be talking about this again probably pretty soon. But I do want to thank you, Asel, and thank you, Luca, for being on the program. Of course, a big thank you to Nathan Shoemaker, who's our Medjlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And on that note, I will say goodbye and have a good week, and we will be back next week with more on the Medjlis podcast. Take care.